This conference is being recorded.
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone. Apologies again for that little technical delay there. Again, my name is Ula Reeves. I'm with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I'm our regional program director, and Mary Carr and myself will be conducting the webinar today, and we're going to be giving an update on the status of coal plants around the region, coal plant proposals specifically. So just really quickly, again, your lines are on mute and this call is being recorded for future reference. But first, a little bit of background about the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Next slide, please, Mary. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is a regional nonprofit. We're an advocacy organization working on renewable energy, clean energy, global warming issues all around the region. We work at multiple levels of decision making, from state governmental levels as well as much of our work at the federal level. We also work with a lot of the utility commissions and directly with utilities around the region. We've been around for over 20 years, and we have offices in Knoxville, Atlanta, Asheville, North Carolina, and we have another number of satellite offices and satellite staff around the region. We are conducting these webinars as an opportunity to bring our members and supporters into the fold of our work so that people understand the types of campaigns and initiatives that we have going on to promote renewable energy and clean energy initiatives around our region, and hope that you find this valuable and really appreciate everyone taking a few minutes out of their lunchtime to join us for this. And I'll turn it over to Mary for the first part of our presentation.
Sure. Good morning, everyone. I am going to first give a general overview of the Southeast current energy profile, and then we're going to get into the specifics of talking about some of the current proposals for new coal-fired power plants in the Southeast. So traditionally, in the Southeast, we have a very heavy reliance on coal and nuclear power. They make up the majority of power plants from where we actually get our electricity from. And we have very little electricity currently generated from renewable energy sources like solar, wind, and bioenergy. In the Southeast, coal and nuclear power plants both are very heavy water users. They make up the majority of water usage in the Southeast and have a significant impact on our water. And coal plants specifically are the largest industrial source of carbon dioxide, leading global warming pollution in the country. And in the Southeast specifically, all of the states have proposals for new coal-fired power plants. Although South Carolina is now an exception because they actually announced last week that Sandy Cooper announced that they would be dropping the PD coal plant proposal. So specifically looking at coal's impact on the Southeast, in terms of water, Southeastern coal plants actually release approximately 30,000 pounds of mercury each year into our waterways. This affects our fish, and then we in turn eat the fish, and it affects our health. There's definitely air quality concerns with coal-fired power plants. It's estimated that 10,000 people in the Southeast are affected each year by particulate matter air pollution. And again, coal is one of the largest sources of global warming pollution, carbon dioxide. And the cost of coal, a lot of things have been changing. Coal is no longer considered cheap, per se. The price of coal itself has actually more than doubled over the past 5 years. This next slide here actually shows some of the impact that coal has on the Southeast and our economy. As you can see on the slide here, it shows that all the coal that we receive, we actually have to import into the Southeast from other states. Largely, we get it from the Midwest and Appalachian region, but we also import coal from other countries as well. So we're really pouring a lot of money into other states and into other countries rather than supporting our local economies with renewable energy sources that are traditionally more homegrown and have a better impact on our local economies. This map here is the source of Sierra Club, and it just shows where the coal plant proposals specifically are in the Southeast. The blue indicates proposals that are no longer being proposed right now, but all the other colors show where there actually are proposals. And our focus today on this webinar is actually to talk about some of these specific proposals that the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and some of our partners are working on throughout the Southeast. And I think that you're going to see more and more of these proposals turning the color blue, the blue indicating the ones that have been dropped, given that there is a lot of financial risk involved with new coal-fired power plants, and there is looming federal regulation on carbon dioxide. So we're slowly seeing nationally plants being canceled throughout the nation, and we're starting to see some of that happen in the Southeast. Okay, I am now going to turn it over to Ula, who is going to talk specifically about Cliffside.
Hello again. All right, so we're going to start north to south on the coal plants that our organization specifically has been tracking. And the Cliffside coal plant is located in Rutherford County, North Carolina, which is about 50 miles west of Charlotte and similar distance south of Asheville. This is an 800 megawatt unit that is being proposed here to replace five of the older coal boilers at that same Cliffside facility. This new unit would emit 6 million tons of carbon dioxide annually, and these facilities have a tendency to live over a 50-year average lifespan. And so during this facility's lifetime, without the ability to capture carbon, which this facility will not have, we're going to see a significant contribution to carbon dioxide, which we think is a huge travesty for the state of North Carolina to continue to go down the path. So I'm going to give a little bit of background and history on where we are with Cliffside on the next slide, and then I'll move forward with where we are today. So the background here is that the facility was proposed in the 2006 timeframe, and by 2007, the North Carolina Utilities Commission had actually denied the second 800 megawatt unit that was originally proposed by Duke Energy. And so this was definitely a victory at that time that Duke was not allowed to move forward with two massive coal units. Instead, they were allowed to move forward with the one. So it was a partial victory in saying no to coal in our region. But the air permit was approved by the Division of Air Quality for Unit 1. There are a number of lawsuits that have been filed challenging the air permit, and specifically with the lack of compliance that Duke has with the federal mercury MACT standards, and MACT stands for Maximum Achievable Control Technology Standards. And essentially, you know, a little bit more background there. In February of 2008, there was a lawsuit that was settled at the D.C. level. So the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency itself had actually violated the Clean Air Act in exempting coal plants from that maximum achievable control technology standard. And so when that was settled, it stated that all coal facilities, all power plants would need and utilities would need to comply with MACT. And so there were a number of lawsuits challenging that they had to comply with that MAC standard. And so we, in June of 2008, the Division of Air Quality here in North Carolina reopened the air permit and asked Duke to conduct a MAC analysis. And there was also a federal lawsuit claiming that they needed to do that. Unfortunately, instead of actually complying with the MAC requirements in that reopening of the air permit, Duke claimed in 2008 that they would instead become a minor source of air pollution to avoid that MACT compliance. So by becoming a minor source of air pollution, they would change their emission limits on one of the many hazardous air pollutants and essentially bring the entire plant down to a certain threshold so that they wouldn't have to comply with mercury. Unfortunately, what that means is that Cliffside would now be allowed to emit essentially on the order of 134 pounds of mercury, and this is just one of the hazardous air pollutants, but 134 pounds of mercury, while other similarly sized plants complying with the MACT are actually limited more to a level of about 4 pounds per year. And mercury is an extremely potent neurotoxin that we are extremely upset that right now it looks like Duke is getting away with that. So that's just a little bit of background. There have been years of coalition advocacy work going on into educating the public and getting people to testify at public hearings about their serious concerns with the emissions that would be coming out of this Cliffside unit. And, you know, we are ongoing in this direction. So next slide, please, Mary. So where we are today, unfortunately, Cliffside is under construction, and it is somewhere between 30% and 40% complete. As I mentioned on the previous slide, the Federal District Court here in Western North Carolina did accept the minor source claim as sufficient, although we are not going to stop at that acceptance. There are a number of reasons for why that might have gone through in the way that it did. We are still represented by SELC, and we do have folks from SELC on the phone today with us in the state administrative law judge filings challenging the actual air permit that is that is being used right now. Duke has announced an 18% rate hike, and it's coming up this fall, and the North Carolina Utility Commission will be holding public hearings around the state starting in September. And a big part of this rate hike is actually to pay for the Cliffside facility. And, you know, our concerns is that this facility is still not necessary and that aggressive investments in energy efficiency and other more sustainable clean energy forms of power could remove our need for having to invest in another global warming pollution machine. So we are encouraging folks to participate in these rate hike hearings. The other fact of where we are today is that Duke has agreed with the South Carolina cooperatives to sell some of their power from the Cliffside facility out of state. And I'll get into that here in a minute with the PD situation too. Go ahead, next slide, please, Mary. So, you know, we're not stopping our advocacy against Cliffside. We still believe that there are alternatives to building a coal plant. Dominion Utility in Virginia has announced that they are going to create a carbon dioxide scrubber pilot project there, and we know that there are alternatives to just pouring out 6 million tons of carbon dioxide every year. And we really are going to, you know, work and do whatever we can to ensure that this facility doesn't become the problem contribution to global warming that it seems like it is. So the rate hike hearings are coming up. There is a huge advocacy and coalition effort happening in North Carolina. StopCliffside.org is our coalition website where you can stay updated on things that are happening. And would really encourage folks to sign up for e-alerts and things like that. So we did have a huge rally on April 20th in Charlotte, and it was one of the largest protests against coal in the Southeast in the history of fighting coal in our region. So we were very proud of the number of people who came out to say no to coal, and specifically no to Cliffside. Next slide. So as Mary mentioned, last week, August 24th, the Santee Cooper Board voted to suspend permitting and development of a 600-megawatt plant that would have been built in Florence County, South Carolina. This was a huge, huge win for the environment, for the Great Petey River, for the folks who fought this plant from the get-go in South Carolina. It was over a two-year battle, and their campaign was called SC Says No, and the last coal plant fight in South Carolina, and sure enough, it was the last coal plant fight in South Carolina, as far as we know. this was just one of a national trend against coal that is happening. This was the 101st coal plant since 2001 to be canceled in the United States, and so clearly Santee Cooper got it that the economic downturn, the trends toward a national renewable and efficiency standard and climate legislation it's writing on the wall that we are going to be controlling carbon dioxide in this country, and investing in a coal plant is risky, and it is not the wave of the future. We have many other ways of producing power. Now, unfortunately, one of the reasons why Santee Cooper felt that they could turn down the Petey coal plant is because there is a deal now where the South Carolina co-ops are going to be purchasing some of their power from Duke. However, it's still a tremendous win for the environment that we have this coal plant off the books, and we have a blog post. If you want to reference, you can go to our website and look up our blogs for more information on the cancellation of that facility. Mary?
Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about the current coal plant proposals in Georgia. The first I'm going to talk about today is Plant Washington. This is a coal plant proposal in Washington County near Sandersville. This proposal was first brought about in 2008 by 10 of the Georgia Electric Membership Co-ops. There's about 42 in the state, and 10 of them pulled together to form a consortium called Power for Georgians to build this new coal-fired power plant. And Cobb Electric Membership Co-op, one of the larger in the state, was actually the lead group in organizing Power for Georgians. Since January 2008, however, four of these co-ops have actually pulled out their investment into the coal plant, citing the regulatory uncertainty and financial risk. So some of the co-ops in Georgia are starting to see that this might not be the best option for them financially to invest in a new coal plant. The remaining EMCs are listed here below. Cobb, EMC, Patala, which is part of Cobb, Snapping Shoals, Central Georgia, and Upson. And these co-ops are really all across the state. They're not in one specific area of the state. So again, Cobb EMC, when they first began sort of in the midst of developing Power for Georgians, they were actually facing a legal challenge, and they're actually facing a legal challenge today still. A number of the cooperative members, individuals that purchased their power from Cobb EMC, actually filed a lawsuit against them regarding the mismanagement of EMC cooperative member funds in developing a for-profit company, Cobb Energy. So there's been a lot of mistrust and question about transparency in the Cobb EMC territory, and a number of members are feeling very frustrated with the coal plant proposal and some of the secrecy behind it and Cobb's true reasons for deciding to build a new coal-fired power plant in Georgia. So a lot of the members are now starting to look at ways to change leadership in Cobb EMC, that there is more transparency and so that there is more accountability so that they can better understand the reasons behind this co-op and some of the others for building this coal-powered plant, because a lot of the members who the money is actually going to be used to develop this coal plant have not been given the information that they deserve about the forming of the coal plant. So just a little bit of background on Plant Washington. Again, it's going to cost, it's estimated over $2 billion to build. And if you do purchase power from one of the six EMCs I listed in the previous slide, then you are actually one of the ones paying for this coal plant. It's a very unique situation where there isn't a water source close to the coal plant proposal. And so Power for Georgians is actually proposing to build a 30-mile pipeline to the Coney River to withdraw water to use on a daily basis at the coal plant. And then during times of drought, when the Coney River is too low, they've actually proposed as a backup to withdraw water from the local aquifer to help supply for the coal-fired power plant. So it's a very risky water situation there. And then in addition, the global warming pollution that this coal plant would emit would be very significant. It would be like adding nearly 1 million new cars onto Georgia's roads. So what are some of the things that you can do to get involved? Well, just recently, the Environmental Protection Division actually submitted the draft permits and announced draft permit hearings on Plant Washington, and those are going to be occurring October 6th and October 20th in Sandersville. And you can visit our website to find out some more information on how to get involved in those hearings. In addition, there is a coalition of different organizations and people from across the state that are part of Georgians for Smart Energy. So if you want to get involved in that group, you can go online to georgiansforsmartenergy.org and sign the pledge. And then, obviously, if you are a member of one of these cooperatives that are involved in building the coal plant, it's very important to get in touch with the leadership there and let them know your concerns about the coal-fired power plant and why you do not want to see your money as a member being invested in such a risky option. The other coal plant proposal in Georgia is Longleaf, and this proposal was actually put forward really in the early 2000s, and right now it emits a number of legal challenges in the courts. Greenlaw, who is actually Justine Thompson, their director, is on the phone today and can answer some questions, has taken the lead with Friends of Chattahoochee and Sierra Club to challenge the air permits that were issued for Longleaf. And right now, just recently, the Court of Appeals voted on a Fulton County District Judge decision and upheld one of six issues that the judge ruled on, one being that the air permit is invalid as written due to lack of the impartial review. So that in itself is a victory, although there are still some questions about the what the limits will be on this coal plant in terms of carbon dioxide and particulate matter. And Justine can answer some additional questions on the coal plant at the end of the call. Okay, Ula, do you want to talk about Seminole?
Yeah, so the Seminole Power Plant is a proposed facility by Seminole Electric Cooperative in Putnam County or Palatka, Florida. This was started in about 2006 as well, similar time frame as Cliffside. It's a 750-megawatt proposal. And after initial proposal, there was a permit application that was under consideration by the Department of Environmental Protection in Florida. And Southern Alliance for Clean Energy and other organizations submitted comments, concerns about procedural concerns about that air permit. And we had pointed out a number of concerns that were later ignored by the Department of Environmental Protection, but when Governor Crist got into office, he actually denied that permit because his goal was to deal with global warming and he wanted to stop the facility. Now, after he did that, there was Seminole filed a lawsuit saying that that was illegal, and the Fifth District Court actually overruled that permit denial in July of 2008. So DEP went on to issue the notice of final permit and the construction permit in September of 08. And at that time, we filed suits in conjunction with Sierra Club, appealing that permit on the same grounds as we had originally pointed out some flaws in the permit when it had originally come out. And again, as I mentioned, DEP had ignored our original concerns and gone forward with issuing that final permit with those flaws originally in it. Now, Sierra Club is pursuing that specific lawsuit, and they will be seeing that forward this fall, and so we may see some resolution with that specific case. And meanwhile, Seminole Electric Cooperative has also made a revision to their permit in a very similar fashion that Cliffside has, that in order to get away with not complying with the Mercury MACT standards, again, these federal Mercury MACT standards, they have changed their permit as well to claim that they will be a minor source of air pollution. And we have filed a specific challenge against that claim. And we have a petition, and we're requesting a hearing on this specific permit modification because, again, in the same case as Cliffside, we feel very strongly that these facilities need to be held accountable to the federal mercury standard. And by claiming this loophole of being a minor source does not do the environment any good, and certainly is just a way to circumnavigate the actual laws that are there to protect public health and the environment. Next slide, Mary. And I should say on Seminole real quick that the opportunities for engagement, at least from a public level, are pretty limited just because most of the challenges right now are legal. But if folks are in Florida, we can talk about connecting you with some opportunities if you want to get involved. And real quick before we wrap up here, I wanted to go over the language that was in the American Clean Energy and Security Act that passed through the House in June. And this is, folks may be aware that there is a federal climate bill that many hope will become law if all goes well, maybe by the end of this fall. The problem is that there is a bit of a grandfathering loophole, again, already written into the ACES, that's the acronym American Clean Energy Security Act. The ACES bill would essentially exempt 43 new coal plants that have been proposed around the country from complying specifically with the new source performance standards that would be required for new coal facilities going forward. So essentially, any new facilities after 2009 would have to be compliant with this new source performance standard that would require that they capture and store at least 50% of their carbon dioxide emissions by 2025. But these 43 new coal plants, which include the ones that we've gone over here today, are either under construction already, they're near construction, or they are initially permitted. And so while they would be subject to the cap and trade provisions of a climate bill, they would not have to meet these new source performance standards. And it's good that they would still be held accountable to the cap. However, the cap is currently written, at least by 2020, is just an 18% below 1990 levels of emissions by 2020, and this is an industry-wide cap, and so it allows the buying and selling of credits. And so a facility could, in essence, buy a number of credits and not ever actually reduce their carbon dioxide emission standards, whereas if they were held accountable to the new source performance standards, that is applied on a facility-specific basis, and they would have to be accountable to it. And so under the cap, we would still see some emissions, but again, because it's one big cap, we would see some emissions going down in some places and actually some emissions going up in other places at other facilities where they're simply buying those credits. And so we see this as a loophole and hope that anybody who is tracking this process with us will help to be advocates to ensure that we can bring all of the coal plants, whether they're, you know, ancient or brand new, that they all become held accountable to the same standards to reduce their emissions significantly. Because we know that, you know, coal plants in the United States are absolutely the biggest contribution from a single source to global warming, and we have got to be doing our part to really bring the emissions down. So that is it for our presentation portion here, and we'll go ahead and open it up to question and answer. If you do want to ask a question, you can hit star 6 on your line to mute or unmute your line as it may be. And I believe you can also chat in some questions and Mary can field those for folks.
This is Dave Kyler. I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
What is the objective assessment of the technology for capturing and storing CO2 from coal plants? This is commonly used as a way of advancing the seemingly paradoxical notion of clean coal, but it seems a highly skeptical approach to me.
Well, it is a technology that is just up and coming at this point and still requires further research and development to ensure safe use of it. The actual process of capturing carbon dioxide from the waste stream of a gasification facility, it's not completely new technology. I think, you know, one of the concerns with safety is how we do the sequestration. There are a lot of unknowns about pumping CO2 into the ground, either in geologic formations or underwater. And so that's what seems to be, you know, the biggest safety concern. The price of carbon capture and sequestration at this point is very, very high. And so, you know, we definitely need some more investment there in terms of, you know, bringing the cost down and making it a viable technology. Now, you know, our perspective is that, you know, we would much rather see energy efficiency and renewable energies used first and foremost. But there is going to be, you know, a certain segment of the utility sector that is going to pursue carbon capture and sequestration, and at least from an emissions standpoint, capturing that carbon dioxide out of the air, if we can sequester it safely, you know, is going to be a transition technology that will be used. So, you know, our hope is that we can do it safely on a limited basis and put more of our investments where they are really sustainable. Because ultimately, you know, even if we're cleaning up the waste stream of coal, we still have a significant problem of extracting it and transporting it, you know, many, many issues with coal from cradle to grave.
Do you have any kind of a fact sheet we could use as a basis for submitting comments that express our skepticism about capturing and sequestering CO2?
Yeah, I'm sure we can get you some information on that. I don't think we have anything specifically on the website at this point in terms of a fact sheet there, but we can get you some information.
Yeah, we have testimony that was filed, too, on our behalf at the Georgia Public Service Commission on IGCC through Georgia Power's past integrated resource plan, too. So I can get you that, Dave.
And who gave that testimony? Do you remember?
I cannot think of his name off the top of my head. But I will find out.
He was a friendly witness?
Yes. he was nice.
Other questions?
This is Paul Messerschmidt. I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
My question goes to, who are the underwriters for the debt, especially for these munis? I understand there's a coalition of some of the major financial institutions in New York who are very skeptical of the risks associated with funding for coal plants, and that's been, I think, one of the reasons why Florida, Tampa Electric, actually dropped one of their plants as the their funding source wasn't going to sort of continue on and or had so many risk issue related issues that they backed out. Do you have any info on that, please?
Yeah, Mary, you may want to jump in here too, specifically on the munis. But yeah, it is becoming definitely a concern in the financial sector. I think the Wall Street Journal at one point came out and said specifically that they didn't think that investing in new coal plants was a wise investment venture, and we don't even call it an investment at this point. It's a money sink, and it's very risky for the ratepayers who are having to, you know, suck up the cost for the bad investment for these utility companies. Mary, do you want to talk more about Plant Washington on the munis?
Yeah, well, on the cooperative side of things, I know that there still is a lot of question on who the actual investors will be, who the different cooperatives pulling together to build this coal plant, where they're going to go for their money. And a lot of the members have concerns about that because they are essentially shareholders in the cooperative. So what we do know is that traditionally the co-ops have gotten money from the Rural Utility Service with different loans, but there was a moratorium on investing on new coal plants for the RUS. So I think you're going to see a lot more of the co-ops that traditionally went for money through RUS going for money through Wall Street instead.
Do you have additional information on that RUS issue? Because I think that's extremely important. And also, is RUS actually using federal money, or are they just a conduit again for Wall Street? And then follow-up question on the PD plant. I saw from the press report that they already spent $250 million. Any idea who's going to be a buyer for some of those unused parts?
Mary, do you want to take the first part on RUS?
Sure. That is a good question. I believe that it's federal money, and that's why the moratorium was put on it, but I can confirm that for you.
On PD, I've seen similar numbers about the amount of money that was already shelled out there, and I have not seen a specific, any specific thoughts on how they're going to recover those costs or sell those. I don't know if Gudrun or anybody else on the phone might have an answer for that. If anyone wants to talk, star 6 to unmute your line.
Oh. Hi, this is Karen Bunnell. I have I'm a member of FACE, which is the grassroots nonprofit that formed in Washington County to oppose Plant Washington, and I'm curious about how we can go about getting information about the financing of this plant, because this is the first I've heard anybody having any information. Power for Georgians and all of the other developers are obviously very close-mouthed about that, and I have done everything in my power to write and publicly oppose the plant. But it's very difficult to get information and know that it's correct information. Do you have recommendations as to how to go about? Because I'm obviously one of the shareholders that's going to be left holding the bag if this thing gets started and permitted and then dropped.
Well, I think that one way that you can start is going to the Georgia Public Service Commission.
Mm-hmm.
They regulate Georgia Power, and although they don't regulate the electric membership co-ops, the co-ops do have to submit certain information to them when they do go in for a loan application. So I think it's important to engage through the Public Service Commission on this issue, since they do deal with some of the financial components for the cooperatives. And I think it's important, too, if you are a Washington EMC member, to contact Washington EMC and ask them how they're planning to finance their portion of the coal plant.
Okay.
This is Paul Messerschmidt real quickly. I was involved in a campaign when Hydro-Québec was proposing to build some large dams in northern Quebec, and we were able to look through, and this is not easy reading, but to read through the annual reports of each of the municipal utilities, and they're required to state who their financing source is. They'll list all their bonds, and there's probably going to be a lot of them, but you'll start to see some regular names pop up and who the primary underwriters are. And we were involved in a campaign then to target the major underwriters, engage in dialogue and conversation, and at least let them know that this was an issue. So it's not easy homework, but it can be done. All of their annual reports for each of the munis, you may have to go one by one and find out information about their financing source. And then if you call their financial officer at each of the munis, they should be able to tell you both existing and any pending financing activities that they have going on, and that can be another avenue for conversation and dialogue.
Yeah, it's a good suggestion. And as Mary had mentioned previously, we have had a lot of issues, particularly in Georgia, with the co-ops being very secretive with their information. If folks do reach out and try to get information, if you'll be in touch with us and let us know if you're successful, because we've just seen a lot of unfortunate blockage of what should be public information to members of specific co-ops. Do we have any other questions?
I have, this is Dave Kyler again, Sustainable Coast.
Yeah.
Kind of a general strategic question. I hope to have a guest column soon in the AJC essentially talking about this, but it just confounds me how Georgia, among other states in the Southeast, no doubt, is in such a controversy over water management and yet continues to green light all these plants that use such huge amounts of water as if there's totally unrelated issues. And so I guess the question is, how can we make this more of a central part of water management and clearly you get more people thinking about and advocating an integration of energy policy with water policy?
Yeah, I think that's really important as Georgia's developing their water management plan. And, you know, something to think about is that in Georgia, the way that we currently use our water and the water sources that are most heavily used, you're not going to see coal plant proposals pop up in certain parts of the state. I mean, it's absolutely not feasible to put another coal plant in, you know, the metro Atlanta area around the Chattahoochee or in other river basins. So I think it's very important for us to engage in the regional water planning process and to make sure that this is a priority for those water planning councils.
But likewise, commonly debated or speculated that one of the ways of meeting these water demands in the highest growth areas of the state where there's insufficient water supply, especially when allowing for the demands of other states and watersheds shared with other states, it would be to transfer water from one part of Georgia to another.
Mm.
And of course, that then raises the issue of if we're managing water statewide, why not manage energy statewide, especially when it consumes such vast amounts of water, which are of increasing concern to support continued growth. So, you know, isolating this to watershed, one watershed or another, it seems to be at odds with the reality of increasing demands for water.
Mm-hmm. And how much is that going to cost to transfer the water from one shed to another?
Well,
yeah, and the plant Washington proposal to use groundwater is particularly frightening.
Yeah.
The more we extract of that, you know, basically backup resource for the use of a coal plant is really draining, literally, what we have left.
Especially when there are water-free alternatives that are, you know, proven to be practical.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's a good point, and you know, I think there has been an increase in the amount that folks are talking about water concerns, especially as the Southeast has recently experienced a really bad drought and started to realize that, you know, we can't run nuclear and coal plants when we're out of water. It just doesn't work. It's not sustainable. It's you know, terrible for the facilities themselves to be, you know, running. They're literally having to shut down these facilities, and there are many more sustainable options that we have that can survive through a drought situation, unlike those large water hogs can. And we did, Dave, we created a video. It's on our website on the water concerns for Plant Washington, if you haven't seen that yet.
All right, I'll look at it.
All right, any other questions? We've got just a few more minutes here.
It's Jane from Cleveland to capitalize on what the man was just saying. You know, wasn't it 2 years ago that there's a federal study, I believe, that demonstrates 36 states are slated for some type of water duress, and that was like within the next 5 years, so we're already 2 years out. It just seems to me that emphasizing the massive amounts of water consumption from these coal plants positions the key problem that our country is going to face, which is water shortage. So you kill two birds in one stone because you heighten your public sensitivity to water issues. And my nephew at the time, again, it'll be 2 years ago in December, was living in Atlanta and just talked terribly about the depletion of a major lake in the area that, you know, supplied the water. So knowing what I know about Atlanta, and I remember, too, the mayor praying for rain. So to consider the extraordinary amounts of water that would be mandated, it's preposterous is what it is. And however you can make that appear even more preposterous to the general public, then they would be more apt to be in alignment with your mission to, I think, you know, stop this plant.
Yeah. No, it's a really good point, and we would encourage folks, you know, particularly those who live in Georgia, to work with us. You know, let's get these concerns out into the media. Let's keep educating people. Let's circulate the water video. And I agree, it does need to be talked about more. But we need folks like yourself who can send in a letter to the editor and, you know, make sure the local paper and the local folks are hearing it from you that you're concerned about it.
You know, and it's easy to forget once the rains fall, once the hurricanes, you know, and the water, the rainfall, whatever, does fill the aquifers. So I think to even remind people from a historic perspective that it was just 2 years ago that this is what we suffered. And then position your climate change. Get the most recent climate change data and what are the predictions specifically for Georgia. You know, you've got a 50-person delegation right now in the United States, from the United States in Geneva, Switzerland. So climate change is going to become very big in this country. And Georgia, you know, is positioned in such a way that it would appear, at least to me, that you will have these periodic droughts. So what are you going to do? Put your water at risk for your everyday citizen to build this thing? It makes no sense.
Yeah, no, it's
I mean, I really would strongly encourage you guys just to stay with the climate change data and do that that research and just hit people. And it's kind of a fear tactic, but it's reality. It is real that you must conserve now, not tomorrow.
Okay, thank you.
Part
All right,
the,
well, we're pretty much at the end of our time here, and I want to thank everybody very much for taking the time to listen into this webinar. I hope it was helpful to get an update on where we are with these coal plant fights, and if you're anywhere near one of these, please don't hesitate to contact us. Please do be involved. We need folks who care. We need people who get that coal plants are a bad investment, the wrong direction for the Southeast, and wrong direction for our utilities to be spending our money as the payers of our bills. You know, we really do have a choice and a voice in whether or not these facilities are constructed. So,
and thank you for your hard work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we will stop recording, and this will be up on our website for future reference in our webinar section on the website. You can look at all of our past webinar series, and we hope that you'll join us again in the future for our next update on our work. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.